He's just like, it's bad. There's chaos. They've been the cows. Did you catch that line?
Yeah.
Why?
These bad guys are so dumb. They couldn't tell the difference between women and cows.
Or maybe they could.
Oh.
Yeah.
Welcome, plotters, to this month's podcast. I am Jen McQuaid.
I'm Lydia Malcolm.
And I'm Naomi McQuaid. And you know what movie we're doing because you clicked on the thing.
And boy, did you click on it.
You really did. Blazing Saddles, guys. And what we normally do, if you're just joining us, is that we start with where we learned about this movie, how we came to know this movie. This is in the Mel Brooks lexicon, which after the past few movies we've done, I was like, you know what? We need a soft throw. We need like a real easy movie to review, right? And then I picked this one because it came across in some video I was watching. And I was like, God, I can't remember when I watched Blazing Saddles. And having watched it now, I can't remember having watched it all the way through.
Oh, no.
Ever before now. And I certainly would not call this, now it's a comedy by no stretch, but I would not call it a softball on a number of things that I'm very passionate about.
So you remember when we did Barbarella?
I was there.
Yeah. I had mentioned, you know, Barbarella would have been so much better if it was like a Mel Brooks comedy because he throws a bunch of stuff at the wall to see what sticks.
Yeah.
But the comedy of the 1974 era that Mel Brooks came from is not like comedy that you would find around here, not unless it was edgy. And really edgy comedy now is just more like, my joke didn't stick, so I'm going to say it was edgy.
Well, we're going to talk about it, but did you, okay, so
yeah,
that's how I got here. How did you find out about, learn about, or just quote other Mel Brooks movies that referenced this?
Well, I mean, for me, it was just cultural osmosis. I always knew about the film, but I never watched it.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite YouTubers, Lindsay Ellis, talks about, she likes this movie, so she talks about it, she references. So, like, that's probably where I really picked up different scenes, like the head him off at the pass, I hate that cliche, or Mungo only pawn in Game of Life, or hey, where are the white women at? So there's like a lot of different jokes. She pulls out like some of the better ones, the ones that even to today apply. But I think I watched it like earlier this year and then I watched it again today.
Okay.
So it was like, okay, yeah. Just some of the jokes are landing. So, but the ones that land, they do it with like a 10 across the boards.
How about you, Jen?
I know that I have seen bits of this when it was on TV and now seeing it all the way through on a streaming service. I know that watching it on TV, you will not get the same movie. There are definitely aspects that are politically incorrect by anybody's standards. I think even back in the day that wouldn't be accessible on the TV. But I've really only seen bits and pieces of it. I was never a kid that enjoyed like old Westerns. So this one, even though it isn't really as much a Western as just a farce kind of comedy, it didn't capture my attention in the way that Robin Hood, Men in Tights, or Spaceballs, or Young Frankenstein did. Those are sort of my trifecta of Mel Brooks films. And I think that's probably across the board for most people. But this is certainly a significant movie for movies as well as for Mel Brooks. So I think it's a great place if we're going to talk about Mel Brooks. It's probably the best to start here. But today was the first day that I had seen it all the way through.
I think what you said speaks to my truth, too, that if I have seen it, it has certainly been sanitized.
Mm-hmm. Well, even Spaceballs was sanitized. Like, I remember watching Spaceballs a lot on network television and, like, so many different aspects of it that just got cut. And it was mostly, you know, jokes that just didn't fly anymore. They got cut or, you know, swear words got cut. But there's, like, this slapstick quality to Spaceballs that I don't think is really in Blazing Saddles. For Blazing Saddles, it feels more like just a lot of edgy humor. And you know, in that, like, I'm gonna make a joke and I'm gonna say a swear word or I'm gonna use a racial slur and that's the joke.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll discuss, mm-hmm. I think. But you know what would really season my palate to get into this movie?
Sean Fax?
It would be Sean Fax.
Yeah.
Well, we have about 3.5 pages of Sean Fax notes, which, little side note, a plotter, Sean was like not accessible. He didn't have access to his normal researching tools, and he did this all by phone. So big shout out for the extra effort that he went through to get us this, and we are certainly not going to complain for the amount that he was able to pull.
That's amazing.
Yeah, for your phone. It was, I mean, I don't think any of us here would have gone as far as Sean did. He's a great guy.
For sure. So I have tons of things that I need to probably throw out there before we get into the plot, and then several other things that we would make more sense once we dive into it. So here's number one. Blazing Saddles was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, and it was ranked number 6 on the American Film Institute's 100 Years, 100 Laughs list. In 2006, Blazing Saddles was deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant by the Library of Congress and was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry. Mel Brooks appeared in 3 supporting roles, Governor William J. Lepetomane.
Lepetomane.
I guess so. Yeah, you're right.
All right. A Yiddish-speaking Native American chief and a director, quote-unquote, in line to help invade Rock Ridge, a nod to Hitchcock, apparently. He also dubs lines for one of Lil Von Stoop's backing troupe.
I knew I heard his voice, and then it didn't match the person, and I was like, what is that? Who is that? That doesn't look like him at all.
Casting, along with a lot of other things, was problematic for this film. Richard Pryor was Brooks's original choice to play Sheriff Bart, but the studio, claiming his history of drug arrests, made him uninsurable, refused to approve financing with Pryor as the star. It's like the studio was the town in mm-hmm. In a lot of ways.
Yeah, that makes sense when it comes to the end.
All right. Brooks offered the other lead role, the Waco Kid, to John Wayne. He declined, deeming the film to be too blue for his family-oriented image, but assured Brooks that he would be the first one in line to see it. Gig Young was cast, but he collapsed during his first scene for what was later determined to be alcohol withdrawal syndrome, and Gene Wilder was flown in to replace him. Johnny Carson and Wilder both turned down the Hedley Lamarr role before Harvey Korman was cast. During production for the film, retired longtime film star Hedley Lamarr sued Warner Brothers for $100,000, charging that the film's running parody of her name infringed on her right to privacy. Brooks said that he was flattered and chose to not fight it in court. The studio settled out of court for a small sum and an apology for almost using her name. This lawsuit would be referenced by an in-film joke where Brooks's character, the governor, tells Hedley Lamarr that this is 1874. You'll be able to sue her.
So the moment in the film was between Hedley and the governor. And I think...
Didn't they keep calling him Hedy?
Hedley Lamarr. That's the running gag. It comes full circle towards the very end. But I think the way that it's played up is he complains about it when he's with the governor. And the governor says it's 1874. You'll be able to sue her. And it's like, you know, her. And I think it's the emphasis on.
Oh, it's a fourth wall break.
Yeah. Like all the other fourth wall breaks.
Yes.
But I think that was great that he was flattered. And he was like, I'm not going to fight this. We're going to give her
it's
money.
Hedley Lamarr. And they keep saying Hedley Lamarr.
No, so his name is Hedley Lamarr,
right?
But everybody calls him Hedy Lamarr,
right? After the
actress,
1914, died 2000,
mm-hmm. And she sued him, and Mel Brooks was so flattered he didn't fight it. They just settled out of court. So that's there was a nod to it in the film.
Got it.
Sorry.
No, that's good stuff. In 1979, became only the 10th film to pass the 100 million box office mark. A television pilot titled Black Bart was produced for CBS. It featured Louis Gossett Jr. as Bart and Steve Landsberg, a former Confederate officer named Reb Jordan. CBS aired the pilot once on April 4th, 1975, The pilot episode of Black Bart was later included as a bonus feature on the Blazing Saddles 30th anniversary DVD and the Blu-ray disc. I don't think we got that with our HBO Max subscription. The film did get 3 Oscar nominations, as we said.
No, I'm sorry.
1974, Best Supporting Actress, Madeleine Kahn, who lost to Ingrid Bergman in Murder on the Orient Express. Valid.
Yeah, I'm not mad even for Kahn.
Best Film Editing, losing out to The Towering Inferno, and Best Music Original Song, the title song, which lost to We May Never Lose Like This Again, also from The Towering Inferno.
So, don't mean to interject, but Harvey Korman, right? That's the guy who plays Hedley Lamarr. I don't mean to do commentary on Sean Facts normally. This is where Naomi does it, but
Hey, now. Yeah. That is true.
Yeah, it's Harvey Korman. He plays Hedley Lamarr. At one point, he says, I'm going to get an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. And he didn't. That's sad. But I'm glad that they got 3 nominations.
Yeah. While filming, Burton Gilliam, Lyle, the henchman of Taggart, was having a difficult time saying the word, the N-word, especially to Cleven Little, because he really liked him. Finally, after several takes, Little took Gilliam off to the side and told him it was okay because these weren't his words. Little jokingly added, if I had thought you would say those words to me in any other situation, we'd go to Fist City, but this is all fun. Don't worry about it. Okay. As long as you don't claim to be speaking for everybody, I guess. That's my own personal commentary on that fact. That isn't Sean writing that. And we've got one more that I think I can add here without making it too long. The Hebrew writing on the headband worn by Mel Brooks on the movie poster should translate to kosher for Passover, but it has a deliberate mistake. The first letters were switched, which translates it to something like posher for Passover. The huge coin on the poster is inscribed, Hi, I'm Mel, trust me. And during a speech honoring Mel Brooks as a Kennedy Center honoree, former President Barack Obama mentioned going to see this film at the age of 12. When Brooks asked how he got into the ratings restriction, Obama replied, I think I had a fake ID that I got with my fake birth certificate, before adding, the statute of limitations has passed.
That's pretty good.
And the rest I should be able to do in scene.
1974's Blazing Saddles, a Mel Brooks film. They literally say that in the opening credits.
Yeah, and all of the title cards, like, well, the first couple title cards burn away with, like, fire.
You hear, like, cracks of the whip.
Yeah.
It's very, like, Western film aesthetic.
Yes, and they then pan across a Western or, you know, desert-esque landscape. Yay! And then it's to a railroad.
Do you have any other comments you wanted to make on the credits, the opening credits themselves? Because I've got one Sean fact for that.
Well, then go ahead and spill it, because yeah. It just seemed like title cards to me.
Mel Brooks wrote the music and lyrics for the 3 Blazing Saddles songs, The Ballad of Rock Ridge, I'm Tired, and The French Mistake. Brooks also wrote the lyrics to the title song with music by John Morris, the composer of the film score. And to sing the title song, Brooks advertised in the trade papers for a Frankie Lane type singer. And to his surprise, Lane himself offered his services. Frankie sang his heart out, and we didn't have the heart to tell him it was a spoof.
Aww.
So there's some music notes for you.
Okay.
Okay, so I did note that, like, according to some of the lyrics in the opening song, it says at the very end, he conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way. And I was like, so according to the song, this was the original ghostwriter?
Mm-hmm.
I could have used something supernatural in this.
But railroad work during Reconstruction.
So the first view, I'm looking at the line and I'm like, oh, a whole bunch of white guys. That's good, right? Considering that's not how most anything with great effort was built in the United States. And then I was like, oh no,
mm-hmm.
Right? I was like, Naomi, you should really like put that like, okay, yeah, you should like be real careful. Like maybe you're going to get real racist real fast. Not racist, but you'll be like mm-hmm. racism hyper-focused really fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought. And then in the next, like, my notes go, oh, white guys building the railroad, huh? And then it goes, Asian slur, slave talk, N-word.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah. So basically, they got the people who are actually doing the work on the railroad are all people of color. You can see some very, like, you know, got the Chinese railroad workers, uh-huh. and you got the black railroad workers.
Recently emancipated, because this movie takes place in 1874.
That would have been about a decade.
Yeah.
After the Civil War.
Yeah, which is why, like, this guy, the schmucky guy who you mentioned was having trouble saying the N-word, who is a completely beautiful actor, mm-hmm. but he's just, he rips it out there real fast. He's like, get that,
give us a good old N-word song. We're not going to be saying it because we're nice white people. We're the good white people.
Okay, I don't know if that's true, but we are people who do not say that word.
Right.
Okay.
So being requested to sing a song, and I say, don't give in to your boss's demands without receiving compensation. But the joke here is they don't sing something that you would expect.
Yeah, it's no line song or whatever you'd call it, like a slave song mm-hmm. or like a working song or a sea shanty or whatever you do to like...
Pass the time.
Yeah, like to... I mean, they explained it in Big Bang Theory, if you've ever watched. Like a sea shanty is to like to provide rhythm to work so that your pacing is even amongst divvied tasks, which would be applicable to harsh working conditions, but is hard to look at on the TV. And
right.
So Bart steps up, right? We don't know him yet, but he steps up and a crew of guys steps around him and they launch into a song that I did not write down, but is smoother than silk and a delight to listen to.
Yeah, it's I Get a Kick Out of You, which was not around in 1974.
There's so much that wasn't around, like the turn of phrases, the interactions, like mm-hmm. there's so much that was not, like they did not care.
Right.
About any kind of time continuity. And I'm cool with that.
What's great about these workers, though, is they play it up like they don't know what some of these songs are. Like, Camp Town Ladies Sing This Song.
The guy's like, yeah, I know you. I want you to sing, like, you know, Camp Town Ladies Sing This Song. Dude. And he starts dancing around. And all his white guys start dancing around him, too. And then they're all just dancing around mm-hmm. until the boss shows up. But what I like about that scene in particular is that if someone says something racist or sexist or in general, just very ignorant and you want to correct them on it, one of the best ways to do it is to be like, could you repeat that?
Right. Or you could be like, if someone says a joke that you know is a racist joke,
yeah.
ask them to explain it, because that's the easiest way to get someone who's saying that kind of a joke, you know, to make them see that you're not laughing.
Yeah.
And suddenly the joke has bombed. And I mean, maybe they'll call you an SJW on the Joe Rogan podcast, but oh, darn. That's so sad.
Sorry. You had to explain that you were being a sexist piece of crap.
Oh. Centrist.
Oh, my God. Were you just making fun of somebody's race? Like they were in charge of that, but also that you were like super cool with making fun of that?
Mm hmm. Okay. We're going to be down here for years.
No, it's okay.
But middle management steps in, or it's like the supervisor of middle management. So it's like upper middle management.
He's got the greatest horsework mm-hmm. I've seen in this entire film. He obviously knows how to ride. And he just, they must have been like, could you ride in? And he's like, yeah. And he just rears in multiple scenes with a horse I mean, aside from his character being garbage.
Right.
His writing is impressive.
Right. But he comes in and he sees all of these white guys dancing around, making a fool of themselves. And this is the first time you kind of pick up that Bart, played by Cleveland Little, is kind of like this, you know, Bugs Bunny character.
He is larger than life. And he is like...
He's a trickster.
He's going to be... Yes.
Yeah. He's like, you're an oppressive force and I'm going to trick you into submitting to my authority.
He's going to take your ignorance of him and make it hilarious.
Yeah. And just a side note, a lot of Jewish folklore is kind of filled with these, you know, characters that are like Bugs Bunny.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't pull out any specific examples right now, but I think this was kind of used against Jews in the times when they have been persecuted immensely. And, you know, it's just like it's this form of bigotry. So you know how when black rappers or, you know, black men and women will use the N-word, but they use it in like reclaiming kind of a stance?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's kind of how the trickster archetype in Jewish folklore kind of came into being. You know, they were constantly expected to be greedy or, you know, to trick people, and then they can turn that around.
Yes, because it's much easier to, if you establish a caricature, to say, obviously, I'm not this. Right? It's why we have like the bimbo woman status portrayed even in this film. And like, we can be like, well, obviously the women you know and the woman before you is not what this is.
Right.
And so let's get back to the facts, you know?
Right.
And like, I'm not, that's not bad. That's not a bad learning tool, I would say.
But on the flip side, when Bart kind of steps up and, you know, shows his intelligence, he also is one of the two people who gets chosen to check out the quicksand at the, yeah, at the end of the road.
Dude's like, go send two N-words to go check out this quicksand up ahead.
Right, because they don't want to, because horses are too expensive, but not people.
Yes, so they put him on a handcart, right? And since they've just gone through this whole scene making fun of, like, Camptown Races, as they're doing the handcart, you know what I'm talking about, the handcart mm-hmm. on the railroad tracks.
Right.
As they're chugging away, they start singing Camptown Races.
Yeah.
And then they do this beautiful shot of watching them, like, the lighting's really great. The Charlie, the guy on the right,
mm-hmm.
he, now, like, straight face on, he doesn't. But from the side, he reminds me of that comedian Hannibal.
Burgess.
Is that yeah. his last name?
Mm-hmm.
He just looks like him in my head, and so I was, like, instantly endeared to him. And then they start having back and forth, and they're like, is the world getting taller?
Yeah, like, no, what's not water, but what's not earth? It's quicksand! And they start going down into the quicksand with this trolley.
Yeah, so then dude and his crony shows up, and they're like, oh, no, get a rope! And then they pull the cart out, and he's like, didn't want to lose a $400 cart to the quicksand. And then there's Charlie and Bart, like, chest deep, and they have to struggle their way out.
Right, which they do. So they show their intelligence in trying to get out of the quicksand.
Well, those other two have, like, a back and forth, and I don't remember what all they said, except for that they need to reroute the railroad through the town.
Right. So they're, like, coming out of the quicksand and everything, uh-huh. and the guy in charge is like, well, you guys have had enough of a break. You got to get up and
he head throws back. A shovel at him.
Well, no, they get told to get back up and not to be lying around taking a break because yeah. get into town because it's not going to do him any good anyways. bad joke. And then Bart's like, he grabs the shovel that's next to him. And Charlie's
that's what they threw down. Mm-hmm. They're like, get back to work.
Right. And so Charlie's like, don't do it, Bart. And Bart's just like, no, going to take some anger out on this
guy. Yeah, he totally whacks What's-His-Face upside the back of the head.
Right.
that's great.
And
oh, yeah. He's asking his crony to take notes for him. And he's all like, it's like, right, Hetty, and tell him I said, ow! Because he gets whacked yeah. with the shovel right then.
Oh, it's like, it was like... So it's more like, you know, it's taking down the telegram, and it reminds me of Quest for Holy Grail.
Yes, yes, yes. The great monster of...
Why would he write, as he's dying?
Wouldn't it just cut off?
Yeah. And then we have a scene change.
So we meet Hedy Lamarr, who is, like, just... He borderline's effeminate, right? Well-dressed man, well-appointed room. He seems... super, like, every white guy villain you've ever seen in anything, especially a Western. So he's right. got his little cravats and his vest and his chains and whatever.
He is the attorney general of this area or the state, I guess. And he's the one who's kind of overseeing the railway production.
Right. And he, in this scene, and here's the thing, there's lots of jokes, right? But they're not, like, relatable jokes. You have to watch them jokes. So unfortunately, part of my notes just fall by the wayside of, like, what comes next. And the comedy of this scene comes from the way that he speaks. And it would take way too much better note-taking than I've got.
Right.
But he's just like, oh, my brain, it swirls with cosmic invention.
Right. And the guy that we saw get thwapped on the head in the last scene, he's in this scene and he's got, like, a wrap around his head.
Mm-hmm.
And we also hear something bang outside of the office. And the attorney general goes to the window, throws open, and he sees that you have a hanging going on.
Yeah, there's permanent gallows outside his house. And that's when I learned that... Boris the Executioner is a running gag in all of these Mel Brooks films that I've seen. I was like, what?
Don't remember him in Spaceballs.
No, no.
Robert Wrigley's medieval hangman returned in Mel Brooks's Robin Hood Men in Tights in 1993.
Right.
You know what they say. No nooth is good nooth.
Yeah. So, and he's about to hang a guy in a wheelchair, and it's like, I think this guy's supposed to be, like, a murderer, but it's like, it's the joke is that
this is a lot of heavy work.
Yeah.
Is what he says to the guy.
And he doesn't have any extra staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's booked up.
He's like, well, keep it down if you can.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the information that's shared in this scene is Rock Ridge is going to be have a railroad through it. The land is about to get very valuable.
Right. They're trying to get everybody out of the town so they can get this this railway to go through. And so Lamar is talking to his henchmen, like head of the henchmen, and they're trying to figure out how they can go ahead and get everybody out of this town. And so he's like, oh, we'll just go ahead and run through there. And oh, he calls it a plan number six, and it deals with like killing all the men and raping all the women.
Yeah,
and
yeah. The first is let's kill all the firstborn sons.
Oh,
to which
yeah.
Lamar says that's too Jewish.
Yeah.
And then he's all like, okay, we'll go through, we'll kill all the people and we'll all the women.
Yeah, at the dance later. Which is like, what?
Like, who drops that?
Yeah.
As a joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then my notes are like, and that's the one he chooses.
Yeah.
That's the one he chooses.
And then he like he's so excited that he grabs his henchman by that side and he's like, oh, I got hit in the head by one of our workers, but he doesn't say it so nicely.
At one point he gropes a statue. This scene is all over the place.
Yeah.
But so then henchman is like, oh, I got hit with a hammer. Mm-hmm. The guy who did it is in holding downstairs. Can you kill him for me? And dude's like, cool, 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 tight, tight, tight. Sticks his head out the window again. And he's like, hey, can you kill this guy for me? He's like, I'm all booked up until Monday.
Yeah.
He's over the top. And so then he's like, awesome. And that's just how Bart's going to die.
Right, at this point in the movie. Also, like, I have a note here. Don't coddle the white man. Like, at some point with these two, you see a lot of moments where there's a level of intimacy.
Mm.
And like, maybe it's a nod to the fact that effeminate villains are used quite regularly in film. Maybe it was a thing in Westerns. I don't know. I don't watch any Westerns. If any applauders regularly watch Westerns, please let us know.
That might be part of my problem with this movie is I have never been into Westerns. And I mean, I conceivably know about them, but I don't in practical terms know about them.
Right.
Anyways. So.
Next scene, Attack of Rock Ridge.
Well, I call this the good old town song.
Right. So because it starts out and I'm like, as soon as this song comes on, I was like, is this a musical? Is this Paint Your Wagon? Have you ever heard of Paint Your Wagon?
No.
First time I heard about Paint Your Wagon was on The Simpsons. They sang this song called Gonna Paint Your Wagon, Gonna Paint It Good, Gonna Paint Your Wagon, We're Gonna Coat Some Wood. Anyways, oh, that's who it is. It's a musical with Clint Eastwood.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Clint Eastwood is not the name that comes to mind when I hear musical.
I know.
Eastwood is just gritting into the camera and gritting his teeth.
Well, not in Paint Your Wagon. He was singing. Everybody gets attacked, you know, someone.
Well, they do. They're like, the song is like, you know, it's a great old town and everybody's nice and we all do stuff and there's the saloon and everybody's cool. There's some cows in the saloon.
Yeah. And everybody and there's no ruckus and everybody's good. And then one day everything turned awful.
Yeah. There's a brawl breaks out. There's rustlers and chaos. They knock over the 5-cent shower stall and there's a naked guy covered in far too many suds.
There's a guy who gets lassoed and he gets dragged through the street and is like, well, there goes this suit. Also, there's an old lady who's getting beaten.
Yeah, she gets punched.
Yeah. You're supposed to sympathize with her in this moment, but maybe you should remember her for later in the movie.
Yeah, maybe she's a piece of garbage, like all of the white people in this film. So then we go to the church.
Right. So the song keeps continuing,
uh-huh.
But it continues in the church where everybody is singing this as though it's a hymn.
It is a hymn.
Yeah.
And it's bad. And then it's like the real first face-to-camera sort of moment because they're singing what's happening in the town.
Yeah.
And it concludes with, and the town is turning to shit.
Yeah.
Something very close to that. And then the reverend or whomst-ever is in charge of this congregation has them all sit. Oh, yeah, they call him reverend about 1,000 times coming mm-hmm. up. Okay, so yeah, he's reverend whatever. And the next, 4 minutes? Is just white guy after white guy yes-anding every other white guy.
I also think it's just one big Johnson joke.
Yes. Everyone on the town council is called Johnson.
Best part of this scene is the phrase authentic frontier gibberish.
Yes. Yes. The guy stands up and he's like, well.
No, the.
Oh, because the first guy who stands up
is the reverend. The reverend's talking and he's like, I'm going to be getting out of here. And then you get the first guy who stands up.
I named him Varmint Guy.
Yeah, it's Gaddy Johnson. I remembered his name. But he was like, you can't do that. You live in
a river. He's in his long johns with his floppy felt hat and his beard. And is like, probably has a pipe or something. And he might as well just be like Cotton Eye Joeing the entire time. He's just like, it's bad. There's chaos. They've been ripping the cows. Did you catch that line?
Yeah.
Why?
These bad guys are so dumb. They couldn't tell the difference between women and cows.
Or maybe they could.
Oh.
Yeah.
Going back to the varmint guy, if you want a nice picture in your mind and you have watched Gravity Falls.
That's what I was thinking too.
Fiddleford McGucket.
Yeah. I did not know his name.
I remember that name. It's a great name. Dynamite!
Yeah, he's like, the reverence concludes, he goes, I'm going to read you from the book of...
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Duck.
Yeah, and he ducks behind the pulpit.
Because as he's running through it, as soon as he says Luke, Dynamite comes through the window. And then we're in the governor's office.
Yes. Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is the governor.
And his secretary, who I think gets the name, but mostly she's just the bikini lady.
I did, now that we've kind of introduced Mel Brooks as Governor William J. LePetitmane, I think I got it better this time.
That's pretty good.
LePetitmane refers to Joseph Pujol, a performer in 19th century France who was a professional farter using the LePetitmane name as his stage name.
Monsieur LaFarts?
I know some people that could be professional farters. Maybe they're just, hey. I didn't say anyone in particular.
We're talking about your mom's dog, Molly.
Oh, gosh. She cleared the room earlier today.
Yeah. It was chemical warfare.
Some people are just born in the wrong century and not in France.
So the attorney general.
Yeah. Hedley Lamarr is.
I've messed that up like four times.
Yeah. He's passing all these bills to the governor saying like, oh, well, we need to get 200,000 acres of land from the indigenous tribes in this area because, you know, we know they can't handle it, you know.
I think they claim that they're mismanaging the land somehow, but it's just a grab.
He refers to them as children.
Oh.
Yeah. And then the governor's like, what are you talking about? How much is that going to cost us? And he's like, oh, just a box of these.
Yeah. And he pulls out paddle balls. Do I mention now that Mel Brooks is cross-eyed this entire time?
Because the first time you see his face, it's coming out of cleavage from his secretary, who's wearing a very skimpy outfit, which isn't the first time that I've seen Mel Brooks in a powerful position role. And he seems to, you know, kind of be a bit of a lush.
It's interesting because I don't know what makes him feel like he calls her lady bits or her, you know, her tatas.
Yeah.
Calls them red devils. And then later he calls her a wild and like just the language in this film. And I'm like not easily set off by language, but I am by like white passing people like just dropping words.
Yeah, and it's also very jarring because she's the only woman in the scene. She's scantily clad, and it's like, is the joke supposed to be that she's scantily clad, or she's the only position, you know, or the only place that a woman can be in this group of men in the 1870s, or even today, is if she is eye candy.
Yeah, there are four women in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, run away. Okay, thanks.
She is almost literally a sexy lamp.
Yeah, quite literally. You could replace her with, you know.
Yeah, there are four women in this film. She is one of them. Mm-hmm. She got a name. Hey, right? Schoolmarm earlier.
Oh, no, later.
Oh, not yet?
Yeah, not yet.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, we haven't even got to the good stuff.
Right. And so the important thing about this scene is these are a bunch of men who are making laws, and it's supposed to show... you know, how the governor is, you know, he's not really paying attention to his job. He's only wanting this so he can be lazy and just kind of let things slide. And he's letting someone else kind of do the work. And that person is, you know, essentially the bad guy, which is not how systemic racism works. But, you know, we're not going to talk about that because we would be here all day.
And so from when we did the best Christmas pageant ever, and I was like, on a scale of 0 to 10, how much religious trauma are we going to bring into this?
How how much political discussion are we going to bring in this?
I mean, like, if what's the gentleman's name who plays Bart?
Cleveland Little.
If Cleveland Little is like down and he did a great job,
mm-hmm.
he's very handsome and he's allowed to say whatever he wants
mm-hmm.
about himself and his own, you know, position on his, you know, use of wordings. And he assuaged the fears of the other guy.
Yeah, from saying the N-word.
Yeah, I'm okay with dismissing a lot of the word usage.
Right.
That doesn't mean it doesn't drive me crazy.
Right. Also, that is not us saying that he's speaking for an entire race of people.
Yeah.
Because no race of people are a monolith.
Okay.
And
here's the thing. I've listened to other women speak about women, and I have disagreed with them.
Right.
And so, like, my little feminism feather is perked up real hard in this film. That being said, this is a much broader discussion. We're not trying to minutia it. Like, on a scale of 0 to 10, how offended do you want to be by the end of this movie that I literally picked because I thought it would be a softball?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's I would think that anything above... I mean, I would almost say anything above a like keep it at a 5 because
okay.
we're not trying to, you know, solve racism with a podcast, with this one single podcast.
Our white asses cannot hold the entirety of the conversation that needs to be had.
Right.
And fully discuss the things this movie brings up.
And I don't want to think that, like, I definitely don't have the education needed to have that conversation.
But I'm open to learning
mm-hmm.
and knowing what in this movie kind of sets me off. Is a good starting place to mm-hmm. explore. Right.
Correct.
So,
at the very end of the scene, we get a telegram from Rockridge requesting a sheriff because their sheriff has been killed and they need a new one. And the governor is like, we have to protect our jobs. And then he's like, harumph, harumph. And he's like trying to get everybody to do a harumph.
And then he directs to camera.
Mm-hmm.
There are 3 solid directs to camera in this film. And that's one of them. And I was like...
Yeah, break the fourth wall.
But if it saves Bart from the gallows,
mm-hmm.
let's do it.
Right, because, well, it's...
Oh, because...
No, this scene with the governor, it's the next scene
oh.
that Lamar gives the direct to camera because he's the one who's like, I will make it my personal mission to make sure that they get a sheriff and they are not stuck without one.
Yes, but also that they're going to have a sheriff who fails so that the property values remain low so that he can make
right.
a killing.
Lamar is 2 different people in the scene with everybody else. He's the one who's like, I'm going to make it my mission to get them a sheriff. And then in the next scene, it's just by himself. And he's like, I don't want a sheriff in there, so I'm going to have to find a sheriff who's going to easily get kicked out. And that's when he directs to camera. He's like, why am I telling you this?
Right. My favorite part of that scene is where he almost chokes on a hard candy.
Yeah.
After he looks out the window and is like, hey, don't kill that one.
Mm.
He's going to be my sheriff.
Yeah.
And then he like chokes on it. Choke. Choke.
Yeah. So, you know, did you guys notice that in the 2 scenes where we see the gallows, we do not see, do we see anybody else? Like, do we see any persons of color or are they all white people?
On the gallows?
On the gallows. Specifically on the gallows.
I don't remember. Like, the people directly adjacent to him in previous scenes were white, but I honestly didn't look.
I don't think that there were, but I vaguely remember the first scene. There was a guy on a horse and he looked real tanned. Sorry, that's bad.
I don't know. I don't know.
It was just very interesting because of the fact that lynching black men in America is a very specific thing that happens even to this day. And the only reason why I bring it up is because YouTuber Lindsay Ellis, who likes this, she does a whole video about Mel Brooks making fun of Nazis. And specifically Hitler and everything. But in Blazing Saddles, she notes that he did not want to show a black man getting lynched because he understands the weight behind that. And so it was one of those things where I was like double checking.
Yeah, for as many Jew jokes as he makes.
Yeah,
right?
but he is Jewish.
Well, yeah, but for as many as he makes, can you recall any time when he showed someone dying in a manner that happened in the Holocaust?
Right. Or like he actually criticized, again, according to this one Lindsay Ellis video.
Yeah, but worthy.
Yeah. She knows her media.
Yeah.
But she said that Mel Brooks criticized Roberto Benigni in the movie Life is Beautiful. Have you ever seen that? It takes place in a concentration camp and it's supposed to show like even in the worst possible place, you can still find joy and beauty. But Mel Brooks kind of was like, no, not in a concentration camp.
He wasn't wrong.
Yeah. And it's like, but Roberto Benigni isn't Jewish.
I was watching a TikTok. I think it was a TikTok that somebody was playing on YouTube. You know how they got shorts now?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was talking about the good Nazi. At Auschwitz, there was a doctor who would like sneak food, and like he was one of the only people who didn't get like condemned after he was put on trial after the Holocaust because he was so good to the inmates there. And I'm like, no, still a Nazi.
Did he, you know, smuggle people out of Auschwitz?
Nope.
That guy.
I can't think of a thing.
Okay,
I just can't think of a situation where you would excuse those kinds of things. And so when you've drawn that line, like Mel Brooks has in this film, to not show such a tragic, demeaning, life-taking, purely vomitous act, the most, like, just the fact that he had the wherewithal to do that, like, applause.
Right. So that was kind of what I wanted to mention before we head on the scene, or away from the scene with the gallows, because like, you know, that seems, because I was watching it again. I was specifically looking for it. And there was a guy on a horse who definitely looked darker skinned, but I couldn't tell if that was just, he almost just looked like a white guy with a real good tan, but maybe that was me. Maybe I'm the racist asshole.
For noticing a guy with a tan?
Well, no, like not knowing if this was, like, it was really hard to tell.
No. You can't clock everyone, Lydia. That's not your job. That's not even what this podcast is about.
Right. Okay. So we're at that point, we're kind of getting above a six.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So Bart is now ushered into the governor's room, and he's behind a curtain canoodling with the secretary.
Right.
And he's Lamar comes in. He's like, hey, I got to talk to you. And he's like, is it important? He's like, the utmost. And he's like, you hear him zip up his pants. He's saying gross, dirty things to the secretary. He's like, cover up, but keep the same position. And I'm like, ew.
Yeah. And Lamar says that this is going to be the new sheriff of Rock Ridge. And the governor freaks out because he's a black guy.
Yeah. He grabs him by the shoulder and brings him over. And he's like, I don't know if you've noticed this, but this guy is a
Yeah.
Right. Turns, looks, realizes that he's got Bart by the arm, and he's like, sorry, hold on. Brings him back, takes Lamar, and is like, this guy is a N-word.
Yeah.
And he's all like explaining why.
Mm-hmm.
But what's great about this scene is like you could take all of them out. Like, I don't need them. Bart behind them, like stealing a cigar and putting his feet up on the desk and like kind of like throwing words in every once in a while in conversation. That's what makes this scene good.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like after, this is probably the last scene where Bart where it shows Bart being kind of someone who's, you know, getting passed around. In the first scene, he had a lot of agency. But after that, it's more like setting up the plot of why he needs to go to Rock Ridge, that you can't really trust the people in power. In fact, one of them is definitely a bad guy. The other one's just kind of doing it for clout. But then after that, Bart is like pretty much in every scene. Almost every scene at this point, and he, like every scene, he just
shines.
Well,
he takes center stage now, yeah.
Yeah. So the whole reason why Lamar is wanting the governor to put Bart into this position, or the way he's spinning it, is you're going to make the first black sheriff, and you're going to be the one who appoints the first black sheriff in the United States.
Won't that look great for your future presidency?
And Bart's the one who says presidency. So yeah, it's one of those nice little nods. And eventually they get ushered out because it's such a promising thing. And then we get into this next scene where Bart's done up all nice.
Oh, you don't want to talk about how Mel Brooks undoes his pants and walks behind the curtain again?
No. I want to talk about how Bart looks really good in this, like, in this
tan outfit.
Pan
slow from the bottom, Mr. Brooks.
You hear
pan
this
slow all the way to the top.
And
that white piping.
He's walking.
That
he's,
matching tawny horse.
Yeah, the horse is trotting through the desert, and you hear this big band, and then you actually see the big band, and the guy who's like playing the piano. He hands with him and everything.
Applauders. This is a full swing band
at
behind those white little towers. Full brass section as he's like swaggering up in the middle of the desert, like non sequitur, like beautifully, like out of place.
Right.
It's great. And then he does like give a good, like, I don't even know what the hand. Okay, here's the thing, white person, but he does that handshake where you like slap hands, slide palms, and then like does the like the grip and
grip of the fingers.
Yeah,
some skin.
He gives him some skin.
Yeah,
in the best way.
Yeah. What's interesting is this is the second time we see the Big Ben aesthetic when it comes to Bart. The first time is when he sings, "I get a kick out of you."
Yes. Yeah. And I love it.
Yeah.
Howdy, applauder. Thank you for joining us for part one of our review of 1974's Blazing Saddles. We've still got two parts to go on this January 2022 episode, and we hope you'll join us for every hoot and holler through this 70s classic farce of Western cinema. Still looking for a hog-killing time after listening here? The after-movie diner sees movies in a real theater and then talk it through in the neighborhood diner afterwards. And Invasion of the Remake explores cinematic remakes with gold nuggets of good ideas on how they could be updated. Check out links to these shows in this release's description. Hey, this is your audio engineer and the only vaccinated council member, Johnson Johnson. Actually, it's Jen. Isn't it great to put your name behind something you're proud of? You can do that too by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts and Podchaser.com. And Spotify now offers ratings, so we'd love to hear from you there as well. It's a great way to help boost our name in search engines, along with giving you a small and selfless sense of accomplishment. We'll be back in 1 week for part two of our review. Y'all come back now, you hear? From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.